Welcome back to another edition of the ASAP Equal Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jason Woods. Today, we are back with a special addition to the podcast that we just published from Dr. Epstein on antibiotic stewardship. At the same time we recorded that, we had Dr. Jessica Whittle, who's an emergency physician at Erlanger Hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She's the director of research at the University of Tennessee College of Medicine. She's got a PhD in immunology and molecular pathogenesis, and importantly, is the ACEP liaison to the Infectious Disease Society of America. And she gave us a fantastic rundown of by body part or body system, what antibiotics we should be thinking about, common pitfalls, pearls on the choosing of antibiotics, as well as a really good discussion at the end of a few new antibiotics that have been approved for uncomplicated cellulitis that also cover MRSA. So we wanted to add that discussion in here today. There's a ton of information here, so this might be one that you're going to need to pause and rewind. Without further ado, Dr. Whittle.
Why are we even thinking about this? As we learn more and more, we're realizing that antibiotics are not a benign thing, and giving them to patients inappropriately has consequences. And so not only do we need to be sure that a patient needs antibiotics, we need to be sure that we're using the right antibiotic for the right thing. And failure to do so has significant consequences, not only in failure to treat the infection that the patient actively has, but in potentially causing real harm to that patient. I'm going to tell you that I think in very basic terms. And so it's very helpful for me to kind of organize things in the most basic format. You all know how and have known since medical school, how do we treat meningitis? Now, again, we're not going to really talk about neonates and children very much in this talk. This is really targeted towards adults and for a general population. When we need to think about meningitis, most of the time, we're going to treat these with vancomycin, Rocephin, plus or minus coverage for Listeria if they're over 55. But we need to think about a couple things. I have started empirically covering all adults with acyclovir, and that is because as a tertiary referral center for many patients, we're finding very high rates, more than I would have expected, of HSV-positive PCRs later on. And that's not always with the classic sort of lymphocytic predominance, which brings me to the big pitfall of meningitis. The classic teaching from medical school and residency for a lot of physicians was, if there's a lymphocytic predominance, this is viral and these patients are going to be okay. And I've even seen some physicians argue that these patients can go home. But in the first 24 hours of bacterial meningitis, in one study 12%, another study 15% of those patients, early bacterial meningitis had a lymphocytic predominance. And so I think it is a mistake to not consider those patients potentially early bacterial meningitis, and they should be admitted and treated as bacterial meningitis until cultures remain negative, and potentially until HSV PCR can be confirmed. But remember that acyclovir is a drug that binds only viral thymidine kinase. It doesn't bind any eukaryotic protein, so it has few to no side effects. It's also a relatively inexpensive drug. For those two reasons, it has very little potential for harm, and HSV encephalitis, unlike any other viral meningitis, it's actively infecting and destroying brain cells. Given the potential long-term effects of that, especially if you're in a setting where an MRI is not possible, certainly consider adding that on.
So just to review there, Dr. Whittle is recommending vancomycin and ceftriaxone for all adult patients who have concerns for meningitis, and strongly recommending that you start acyclovir until you can confirm via molecular testing that the patient does not have HSV as the primary cause of their issues. We're going to move on next to the sinus cavities, the ears, and the pharynx.
I group them all with sort of one thing because they're sort of contiguous spaces, and subsequently they can really be treated for the most part with the same groups of antibiotics. We're all familiar with Augmentin, cephalosporins, Bactrim, and even doxycycline here is reasonable coverage. One thing that I would really caution against here, though, is use of azithromycin here for true upper respiratory tract infections. And the reason is, as you all know, this is an area of growing antibiotic resistance. So the truth of the matter is we really only need to be treating true otitises, true sinus infections. We all know the definition of that, right? More than 10 days of symptoms with fever. So this is the one that we're all reading about. This is the one where stewardship matters. Patients who've had a runny nose for 3 or 4 days with some nasal congestion, even with a fever, most likely have a viral infection. Treating them with azithromycin just is contributing to resistance, causing long QT. What it's not doing is treating their viral infection. Remember, especially for those URI, people want to feel better. And if they're a reasonable candidate, steroids may be an option for that. You all know how to treat dental infections and oral infections. So augmentin clindamycin, just for uncomplicated dental infections, PenVK is still an option. For severe infections, abscesses, phlegma, Rocephin may be an option. But never forget that for large abscesses and things like that, you need source control. So if you have a huge swollen jaw from a dental infection, you really probably need to drain that big pus pocket.
All right, simple enough. Let's move on down to the lungs.
This, in my opinion, is probably the most difficult and most complicated when choosing antibiotics. So lung infections, really, I think of in two forms, either bronchitis or pneumonia. When you're treating bronchitis, the first thing you have to decide is, number one, is this viral? If it's bronchitis, it may also be chronic bronchitis, right? Kind of a COPD type thing. And then, do they need antibiotics or not? There's a great Cochrane database review on when to treat those patients with antibiotics, and I would refer you to that. Really, it boils down to is older patients, patients 55 and older particularly, can show improvement of lung function faster when treated concomitantly with antibiotics and steroids compared to those treated only with bronchodilators and steroids. So, and in those patients, though, it's very unclear as to what the right antibiotic is. And so I'd like to be very clear saying these are the things that I often worry about. However, there's lots of other opinions about the best antibiotics to use for bronchitis, and some people feel that simple coverage of strep pneumo and basic lung organisms with things as simple as amoxicillin may be adequate coverage in these patients. And so that is a reasonable opinion to have. That being said, if you want the most simple suggestion for how to treat what you believe to be a bacterial bronchitis or a COPD exacerbation, a severe asthma exacerbation, that in an older patient who would benefit from antibiotics in addition to their steroids and bronchodilators, then I most often use doxycycline. It's also reasonable to consider clarithromycin or azithromycin. And one of the reasons that I use those antibiotics is because I believe that you get reasonable coverage of strep pneumo, but you also get coverage of your atypical organisms. Now, if we've moved from bronchitis to an actual pneumonia, meaning there's an infiltrate on the x-ray or evidence of diffuse lung involvement, diminished breath sounds, etc. So clinical pneumonia, if this is community acquired, the recommendations are that we cover for atypical organisms as well as sort of the big three, Haemophilus, Moraxella, strep pneumo, kind of all of the ones you're familiar with. And in that situation, you sort of have any of these options, augmentin, cephalosporin, Bactrim. I like a lot of first and second generation cephalosporins with doxycycline, or inpatient, I use Rocephin and doxycycline or azithromycin. Those are the recommendations, of course, by the Infectious Disease Society of America as well. Levaquin and Avalox are approved in this setting for pneumonia, and they do have reasonably good coverage of gram-positive organisms. They are not adequate coverage of gram-negative organisms. So when I hear people say, I'm going to give them Levaquin to cover the lungs and any urinary tract infection that they have, that is really not an adequate statement. To know that, you really have to be looking at your antibiograms. But they are adequate coverage of the lungs. Last thing I want to say is be aware of what hospital-acquired pneumonia is. Hospital-acquired pneumonia, and this is worth looking up. So there's in 2016, the American Thoracic Society and the Infectious Disease Society of America published in Clinical Infectious Diseases a new set of practice guidelines regarding hospital-acquired infections, and I would encourage you to go and read those. Hospital-acquired infections is really not everyone who's been around the healthcare environment. It is people who have required IV antibiotics for an infection in the last 90 days. And so those are the people who you need to broaden out their coverage and think about those and Levaquin, Apenem or Cefepime, depending on their allergy background. Of those people, if they're in septic shock, they have a high mortality rate, or they're on a ventilator, you may need to consider in those settings coverage for MRSA or double coverage for Pseudomonas, depending on your hospital's rate of Pseudomonas resistance.
And man, I just want to hammer home that point from Dr. Whittle on what is considered hospital-acquired pneumonia. It's not just that it's somebody who has been around the hospital environment. Her definition is patients with IV antibiotic need in the last 90 days. They are more likely to have either more virulent or different infectious causes than your typical community acquired pneumonia and require a different set of considerations. But it's not just somebody who has been in and out of the clinic or the office or had to come to the hospital for a different thing that did not require IV antibiotics. Moving right down the body, let's get into the belly.
Zosyn covers pretty much everything. Levaquin or Cipro with Flagyl. I mean, if they're allergic, of course, Augmentin with Flagyl. For C. diff, Flagyl, or oral vancomycin. One of the things that a lot of people like is, and there's some indirect evidence that probiotics can be helpful for these patients, just remember to tell them not to take them at the same time as their antibiotics, or there's some evidence that the antibiotic will kill off the probiotic at the same time. So I tell them to stagger them and take them a few hours apart or take the probiotic midday. Remember, appendicitis is an infection, and those patients may be septic. Even if the surgeons take them to the OR pretty quickly, especially from CMS sepsis bundle standpoint, they may in fact still need antibiotics while they're waiting. Just remember the bladder UTI type infections, that fluoroquinolones are not recommended as first line any longer. And that is because the resistance rate for gram negatives with fluoroquinolones is so high. Macrobid is a great option. Bactrim, cephalosporins, any of these are good options.
All right, so we're going to move on from body systems and talk about a couple of other things. Before we step over into the pitfalls of antibiotic choice and their side effects, I do want to remind everybody that there are other things that can cause a clinical sepsis or SIRS syndrome, including fungal infections, viral infections, and autoimmune illnesses. So think carefully about those, particularly if the patient does not fit your general illness script. So Dr. Whittle, can you review the antibiotic side effects that we need to be aware of and the patient populations that they are particularly important in, as well as where this comes into the discussion of antibiotic stewardship?
Bactrim, particularly in patients over 65 or those with underlying chronic renal insufficiency, can cause renal failure. It has a high rate, known rate of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Azithromycin causes a long QT and an RNT event. Fluoroquinolones now are known to just have all sorts of problems. So from seizures to tendinopathies, they're just difficult, difficult drugs. Clindamycin has the highest rate of C. diff, and of course, Flagyl. Warn your patients of the disulfiram-like reaction. While it is good job security to prescribe that because they will be back for the vomiting, it's probably not very nice.
I guess it's always good to let the patients know about the side effects that they might experience as well. I would add to that that certain antibiotics such as ceftonir or rifampin can change the color of some of the body secretions, urine, sweat, and it's always a good idea to give them an alert that that might happen so they don't wind back up in your ER. All right, we're going to wrap this up in just a little bit with Dr. Whittle going over a few new antibiotics that we need to be aware of, but before we move on, I want to go over a couple of resources that people often forget to use. I think the very first stop in determining your practice patterns, as well as evaluating which drugs are going to be useful for which clinical syndromes, should be your local hospital antibiotogram. It will tell you over the past year what isolates are being grown, how common they are, and what they are susceptible to. And that is going to be your most accurate picture of what your subset of patients is likely to present with. Separately, there are a number of books and apps that are helpful. The ones that I use the most frequently are the EMRA Antibiotic Guide, the Sanford Guide, and Medscape. And that app, I will add, is free. They all contain great resources where you can look it up by drug, by bug, by body system, what the most likely pathogens are, and what you should use to treat them. I will add that I have zero financial ties to any of those organizations or products. I just love to use them. Dr. Whittle, we are going to throw it back to you if you can talk to us about any new antibiotics that have been released or are on the horizon and where we are most likely to use them.
There's a couple new drugs out there and that you might want to know about, and that is two drugs called Dalvance and Orbactis. Both of them are glycopeptides, which means they're in the same class as vancomycin. They are approved for the treatment of uncomplicated soft tissue infections by gram-positive bacteria, including MRSA. Basically, think of cellulitis, that sort of thing. They are 10-day course in a single IV infusion.
Just to clarify here, they are felt to be equivalent to a 10-day course of your traditional antibiotics, but in a single IV infusion.
Dalvance was originally approved in a two-dose treatment, but then was later approved in a single dose. It can be diluted in sterile water or D5W, can be dialyzed off, but it does have to be dose adjusted for renally impaired patients. Orbactiv is a very similar drug, also effective against MRSA as well as other gram-positives. It's a single-dose infusion in D5, and there's no adjustment required for renal impairment. It's never been studied in dialysis or patients or those with hepatic impairment. And it has an unusual property of falsely elevating the PTT for 5 days, However, that's not thought to have any clinical significance. It's not a true elevation. It's a lab abnormality. These drugs are great. For example, we had a IV drug user who had an uncomplicated cellulitis who would have otherwise required a PICC line and infusion of vancomycin for 3 or 4 days, who instead got a 3-hour infusion and then went home. Because this is in D5, they may elevate the glucose, and they may need concomitant insulin therapy. But they were able to go home from the emergency department in a couple hours.
There is so much good stuff in there. This is not meant to be a comprehensive review of everything you could possibly ever want to know about antibiotics, but it is a good overview by body system of some of the common antibiotics as well as where we frequently go wrong. Thank you, Dr. Whittle, for being here to talk with us, and thank you to all the listeners out there. This has been the ACEP Equal Podcast. You can find all of the rest of our podcasts through the Academic Life in Emergency Medicine blog, www.aliem.com, or through the Aliem feed in your favorite podcasting app. We'd love for you to continue the conversation, either by leaving us a review or commenting on the blog posts. You can also find me directly via Twitter at jwoodsmd or my email address jason.woods.md@gmail.com. I've been your host as always, Dr. Jason Woods. Thank you so much for listening today, and we'll see you next time.